I would also like to thank Lenore for the opportunity to be here, and let me start by saying how much I appreciated Richard's remarks. Very interesting. I suppose I'll be focusing on the second approach to the question by asking the ought of American identity throughout my remarks. But let me start by just mentioning that this question, what defines an American, as we know, is a very timely question, especially in a day when universities, for example, are prescribing politically correct ways of speaking and thinking to their students on campus. You may be aware that recently the University of New Hampshire posted a recommendation of preferred politically correct terms in which they discourage students and faculty from using the term American, preferring instead the less offensive term resident of the United States. And I just mentioned this because, again, notice what this implies is that the way we define an American is based entirely on geographical location, that is, the fact that we live in a certain territory. So why has it become so hard to identify what it means to be an American other than by the fact that we live within certain borders? I would suggest that this is largely the result of having forgotten our social compact and natural rights foundations, which is especially the result of the progressive refounding of America. Our natural rights foundations tell us that the human mind is free by nature and that therefore we have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Our social compact principles tell us that governments are instituted to secure our natural rights and that just governments must have the consent of citizens and must be of limited power in nature. A common belief in these principles is what initially defined an American. As Thomas Jefferson wrote to Henry Lee in 1825, all American Whigs thought alike on these subjects. Those principles, as expressed in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote, were intended to be an expression of the American mind. Jefferson reemphasized those common beliefs in his first inaugural. We are all Republicans, he said, we are all Federalists, by which he meant that despite political differences, there are certain principles that unite all Americans, including, he said, the sacred principle that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable, that the minority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. And Jefferson also emphasized the principles of common attachment to union and representative government. These are basic principles that all Americans could and should even today share. In its largest sense, what made an American one an American is a belief in and commitment to these principles and the way of life that necessary follows from them. Those principles inform both the character of American society and of American citizens. A society founded upon those principles should be one in which citizens are free to pursue happiness through individual work and accomplishment. It should be a society in which an individual is free to keep the fruits of his labors, thus providing opportunities to improve the condition of his life and that of his family. Only such a society was suitable for the genius of the American people, as James Madison liked to say. Those principles, especially the dedication to individual liberty, shaped and informed that genius. John Adams, in his piece Thoughts on Government, had predicted that a constitution founded on these principles introduces knowledge among the people, inspires them with a conscious dignity, becoming freemen. That elevation of sentiment inspired by such a government makes the common people brave and enterprising. That ambition which is inspired by it makes them sober, industrious, and frugal. The qualities expected of Americans also included a respect for the equal rights and liberties of others, and a willingness to contribute one's share of necessary support for the society and government that promoted and defended their liberty. In President George Washington's series of letters to religious denominations in 1789 and 1790, he called on Americans to prove themselves good citizens through the innocence of their lives and the beneficence of their actions. By conducting themselves with reverence to the deity and charity toward their fellow creatures, and by being firm friends to civil liberty and the faithful supporters of a free yet efficient general government. These offer clear and reasonable qualities that can inform what it means to be an American even today. Founding principles led to the idea that citizens should be free to work and support themselves and their families and respect the rights of others to do the same. Again, Jefferson described an important American quality when he said citizens should entertain a due sense of our equal right to the use of our own faculties, to the acquisition of our own industry, to honor and confidence from our fellow citizens resulting not from birth, but from our actions and their sense of them. Benjamin Franklin echoed this when he advised foreigners not to leave their homes for America if they have no other quality to recommend them but their birth. In Europe, he said, it indeed has its value, but it is a commodity that cannot be carried to a worse market than that of America, where people do not inquire of a stranger, what is he, but what can he do? This simple but profound statement helps to define the kind of society that is suitable to our genius. Abraham Lincoln summed all of this up most eloquently when he described the principle of equal liberty for all as an apple of gold, a principle that clears the path for all, gives hope to all, and by consequence, enterprise and industry to all. It is this principle that binds Americans all together, Lincoln believed. Whether immigrants or so-called natural-born citizens, even generations after that principle was first enunciated. It is, he said, the father of all moral principle in them, and they have a right to claim it as though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the men who wrote that Declaration of Independence. And we should not overlook a larger point here. This kind of character is not exclusive to those who are born and live in the United States. Being an American is possible for individuals regardless of their place of birth. As my late friend and colleague Peter Schramm loved to tell us, when he asked his father why they were leaving their native Hungary for the United States, his father replied, because we were born Americans in the wrong place. Many of you may have heard that story. So many people come to this country so they can simply be Americans, to work hard and freely pursue happiness. It is sadly something that immigrants often appreciate much more than people who were born in this country these days. In the years leading to the Civil War, many Americans, North and South, had lost sight of the proposition that all men are created equally free. An American identity was restored, many hoped, by the outcome of that war, through a new birth of freedom, as Lincoln put it. But progressive intellectuals rejected our social compact principles and the very idea of natural rights. Americans again questioned the content of liberty and equality. For progressives, Lincoln's apple of gold, which had informed American identity for our first century, was replaced by an identity awaiting us at the end of a still evolving history. The effects of progressive ideology, though not immediate, have had long-lasting consequences. The human mind went from being free by nature to being entirely conditioned by the time and place in which one lived. Traditional self-reliance was undermined by the idea that human beings are nothing without the assistance of the state. The progressive obsession with economic class and special interests emphasized what divided rather than united us as Americans. Equal liberty for all came to mean material equality as a result, and progressive racial science, the belief that some races had advanced historically more than others, tied American identity more to blood and culture than to commonly shared principles grounded in the laws of nature and of nature's God. Despite progressivism's faith in historical development, the cultural relativism that emerged from it replaced principles, truths, with the idea of values. It became harder to say that there was anything permanently good about being an American. Progressive historians had a profoundly negative influence on American identity. Frederick Jackson Turner, in 1891, made the distinction between subjective and objective history, arguing that the task of the modern historian is to engage in a kind of archaeological fact digging so as to correct the biases of former historians, since, as he wrote, all history is informed by the prejudices of its own time. In 1913, Charles Beard challenged the principled motives of the framers of the Constitution, and in 1931, Carl Becker proclaimed every man his own historian, since all history is merely a convenient blend of truth and fancy. In other words, all history is based on the prejudicial values of the historian in his own time and place. Why bother to study history anymore, since history could really teach us nothing in a positive sense about what it means to be an American? Modern history could only teach us that we were not, in fact, what we had always thought we were. This emerging approach to history contributed to the growing doubt that there was anything truly exceptional about America, which led to confusion about our identity, then guilt, and then self-loathing, all of which not only muddied what it means to be an American, but even made a certain degree of courage necessary to call oneself an American. So I've laid out some of the problems and its causes, and I want to maybe shift to hopefully a more hopeful note as I work toward a conclusion by asking, how do we restore a sense of American identity? And I think we all know that education is key to this. And this means that it's very important for us to reform the education of teachers in this country. And by this, I mean we don't need to tell them what to teach or how to teach. They've had enough of this post-John Dewey emphasis on educational science shoved down their throats for the last half century. I'm talking mainly about showing teachers another way of thinking about history, both as a subject worthy of study and as an understanding of our past. I've had the privilege of working with many history teachers over the last decade, and I found that history teachers take their job of teaching history seriously and of creating citizens seriously, but they're often discouraged by a lack of resources, time, and support, and they are often demoralized by bad histories, bad historians, and bad textbooks. I think most teachers want desperately to reveal to their students that there is something exceptional about America, and that there is, therefore, an American identity that is rooted in something positive rather than simply negative. The trick, I think, is to bypass some of the biases that certain 20th century historians have imposed on us. I found that simply by putting primary documents in front of teachers, they begin to see things that they have been told cannot be seen or known. Put original texts or documents in front of teachers, start reading them together. After a little, maybe a lot, of poking and prodding and some teeth pulling, eventually they are smitten by this approach to education. They are amazed that they can rediscover and participate in the conversations that Americans have had since our founding over the meaning of liberty. They hear delegates at the federal convention argue over the justice of slavery. They hear federalists and anti-federalists debate whether the proposed Constitution of 1787 will promote or destroy liberty. They hear Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison, Calhoun, Stephen Douglas, Abraham Lincoln arguing over justice and self-government and whether or not union advances or hinders liberty. They hear Woodrow Wilson and Calvin Coolidge argue over whether the principles of the founding are still relevant. They hear Lyndon Johnson and Ronald Reagan articulate competing visions for the future of liberty in this country. Teachers who study history in this way come to see that it is possible to discern something really substantive and important about the American understanding of liberty, and they do it largely on their own. They realize that a fundamental aspect of the American identity is that we can have these kinds of discussions and deliberations over the meaning of liberty. And in the process of thinking about these things in this way, teachers come to engage in and realize their own potential as free human beings and citizens. And in my experiences of working with teachers, I can't tell you how many times they have said that they come away from this revitalized and re-energized, eager to pass on this approach to their own students. And so, ending on a note of hope here, little by little, these reborn history teachers can do a great deal to reclaim some kind of clarity on what it means to be an American. Thank you.